I looked at my list, but it was no help. It was supposed to be work, and Grandpa was crossed out, and now I would have to cross work out. My hands were shaking too much to do it. I had a glass of water in case I was dehydrated, and went past the window, covering my face with my hand so that I couldn't see the litter tray. I made it to my bed, and I lay down under the covers with all my clothes still on. I had never done that before, either. I would wait for the day to be over, and tomorrow would be another day. The house was completely quiet. My whole week had been filled with unexpected noises, but now there was nothing. The front door closed. I heard it through my pillow, but no one came in, and no children arrived. I was usually happy when the house was quiet, but even under the covers my legs were jiggling and my heart was racing. I did all my coping strategies, but nothing worked. If I could go to sleep, I knew I would feel better, but as I tried to think of something happy to dream about, I heard banging on the front door. Grandpa wasn't coming, and no one was supposed to be here. My neighbours have keys, the doctor's children have keys. No one should be outside, but someone was. I opened the door of my flat, and I looked down into the hall. There was a figure outside. I waited. They would go away. But they didn't. They pulled up the letterbox and shouted in, then banged again, then shouted, and the voice was a girl. I had to make it stop and make them leave me alone. I twisted and weaved my way to the door, and I opened it. This was probably what hell was like. On the doorstep, just standing there, was the girl from the Pure Girls website. Or I thought it was her. She even had the same pigtails. I stood in the doorway and closed my eyes. When I opened them again, she was still there, and she said hello.
"Are you Tam?"
She had an accent, but I think that is what she said. "I am not Tam, I am Nick," so I said no.
"I am looking for Tam, about the cleaning job."
"Clear your head and think about nothing." It was my most extreme way of dealing with things, but this had been a very extreme day. It didn't work. I stood still, but she walked towards me, pigtails swinging back and forwards, and a big smile on her face.
"Do you know Tam?"
"What is his address?" She told me, and it was the right house. I wondered if it was the policeman, but he was called Thomas. I had seen it on his envelopes when I put them in order.
"I can't help. I don't know him. You need to go away."
"Shit. I was counting on this job. Do you need cleaner? I am very good and very quick, and we can be friends. How old are you? We must be same age, and I just arrived in London."
She carried on talking, but I could only hear the general tune of it now, and she didn't seem to need an answer to any of her questions. So when she followed me into the hall and up to my flat, I couldn't do anything. I opened my door and quickly tried to shut it, but she was behind me.
"Come on, be nice. Let me clean your flat. Only £10 an hour, and I will be quick. Let me see."
The energy had drained from my body. More things had happened in one day than usually happened in a month. Worse, Mother and Grandpa were coming in 2 days, and the flat was not up to its usual standard, and I had no job or cat. The girl with the pigtails stuck out her hand and said,
"My name is Martha. What is your name?"
My head was buzzing, but I managed to say Nick. That was all I managed to say before she started opening and closing doors, looking into my bathroom, lifting up the toilet lid, opening the kitchen cupboards. I was unable to move.
"You relax. You want a cup of coffee? I find a bucket and mop here, you very organized man. You have lots of cleaning products. I love these wipes. I can use them? I can put on radio? I clean quicker that way."
I felt invisible and went into the bedroom while she twiddled the knob of the Philips radio I never used and came up with a song which seemed to be mostly a drum that was banging in unison with my head.
"You like rock? You ever hear Polish rock? You can show me nice place to go dance in London. This place won't take more than 2 hours, then clean.
I sat on the edge of my bed and put on my slippers. My heart was racing, but my mind was empty now. I watched her through the bedroom door, dancing and cleaning while she sang along and the radio pounded, and every time she bent down to wring out the mop, her jeans stretched over her bottom and her jumper fell away from her breasts. She wasn't wearing a bra, and I liked her body. It was neat, and she had looked after it. There was no fat and no blemishes. She was on her knees now, scrubbing the floor and wiping over the skirting boards with my cleaning wipes, which I usually ration to 3 a day. She was taking handfuls, and would have to start another packet if she carried on like this. She was sort of dancing on her hands and knees now, and her pigtails were near the bleachy water in the bucket.
In Poland, I think we say you have zaburzenie obsesyjno kompulsyjne. You don't know what I mean, do you? It's when you hate mess. I can see from your neat clothes and your neat hair and your neat cupboards. I love to clean houses for people like that.
It was true I hated mess, but I also hated to feel taken over and invaded. I hated being given labels, and most of all, I hated being teased. I thought about the quiet of the morgue, and I wanted to cry again. The girl I had liked there had been so peaceful that I could have spent all day just sitting next to her. I sat on the sofa, but 5 minutes later the Hoover was on, and she was bumping into the legs of my chair.
Lift up. I have to get all the dust, and then I will be out of your way.
I didn't have strong muscles in my tummy, and lifting my legs straight up was difficult for me. I swung them round, and she laughed. I stood up, and all I could think about was stopping the noise in the flat. I was so close that I could feel her breath, and she stopped laughing then. Her last laugh had left a bit of spit on my cheek, and I wiped it off with my handkerchief.
Are you okay?
I wasn't. The park, the night on the floor, the disruption in my house, work, and now this. She walked away from me backwards, and a new song came on the radio. Bang, bang, and I pushed her backwards. My hands were waving around now, I think, and I could hear the echoes of the laughter of people at school or on the streets from behind as I walked, head down, on my toes. This was too much, and I had to get things back on track. All my rules were falling away, and I tried to remember the list. Make eye contact. I did, and her eyes were scared, and the shape of her body under the jumper was like the girl in the park.
Get away from me, you retarded person.
I didn't like that word. She must have known it was a bad word and just didn't care. I walked around the sofa, the picture of the blood matted into the blonde hair of the girl in the park, making me upset. I needed to make her quiet, and I needed to do it with no mess. I picked up a cushion, and, as I did, she jumped up and ran towards the door. She got to the handle, but it wasn't the simplest door to open. I had taken a long time to learn it. You have to undo the latch, then put the handle up, then down, and hold the latch with the other hand. I easily caught her, but now she was really making a lot of noise, and I was glad she was so small. I got her on the floor easily, and then pushed her towards the sofa so her head didn't get bruised or cut. I didn't want a mess. She was against the front of the sofa now, half sitting, and I pushed the cushion towards her, covering her face, but not wanting to get any spit or germs on me. The problem was that she didn't stop struggling, and her hands were grabbing at my wrists. Then she was digging her nails into my skin. I remembered the screaming into a pillow then, which my grandpa had told me to do if something hurt or when I was agitated or upset. It meant that air could go in and out of a pillow, and I realized I needed something else. The back support cushion on the sofa was harder, and I jammed it over the soft one and straddled her. It was the only way to get her to stop making a noise. I pushed and stretched my head back as far as I could to avoid her arms, which were now groping for my face, so she could stop me, I suppose, and I put all my might into the cushions without making any sharp movements that might hurt her face. I only wanted her to be quiet and go home, but she wouldn't stop. It took a long time. Her feet were banging, the radio was banging, and the Hoover had somehow come back on, and it was loud in my ear. I could hear a muffled noise through the feathers and foam, and then, at last, her arms dropped, and the noise turned into a faraway gurgle, and then stopped too. I thought it might have been a trick, so I only let the cushion go little by little to see if she moved, and then, in the end, I lifted up the edge of the soft one underneath, and I was surprised because her eyes were open. I watched her the whole time while I put out my hand and turned off the Hoover. Then I got up, slowly, and turned off the radio, and then went back and lifted her up. There was a wet pool underneath her, but I had seen that once at the morgue. Sometimes people came in wearing the clothes they had died in, and they were wet. Peter had told me it was all the waste going out of their bodies, so that they were clean like when they were born. I went and got two bin bags, a clean flannel from the bathroom, and I emptied her bleachy water and filled it back up with fresh hot water and a little bit of liquid soap. I had found out at the morgue that if we used too much soap, the skin got sticky. I tried to be as gentle as I could, starting at her feet, because I wanted to wash her face last of all. It was a soft flannel, and I put all my skill into making sure she was perfect, and washed every inch of her. She seemed much more peaceful now, and much calmer. I cleaned the floor and put her clothes into a bin bag, all of them. I wiped the floor over with the antiseptic that kills 99% of all germs, and I felt much better. I rolled her off the bin bags and onto a cashmere throw that my mother had bought, and which was the softest thing I had ever felt. I wrapped it round her gently and put her onto the bed, where I had pulled the duvet back. I looked at her. She was totally perfect, and a soft scent of lavender was coming off her skin. I bent towards her and gave her a little kiss on her mouth. She had the softest lips. Her whole body was so relaxed and limp. No tension anywhere. She seemed much better than when she had been shouting and cleaning and singing and being insulting. The whole time in the back of my mind I thought the police might come, or my neighbour because of the noise, but it was as if I was protected. This is exactly how it was with Grandpa. No one ever came. I got the kit I had been given at the morgue, and I felt happy. I didn't need to go to the hospital to do my job. Marta looked perfect. I just needed to clean off her makeup now. Her eyes were still open, and I wanted to get the blue off her eyelids. It was 9 o'clock and dark now, nearly time for bed. I gently touched her left eyelid, but it wouldn't close. She was staring at me, looking at me with an accusing expression, and I tried again. Her eyes were locked open. She wouldn't close them. And I wanted her to. A lot. I tried again with the other eye, and then both together, but she was staring at me, coldly, like mother when I did something wrong, and I tried to pull them closed. I had turned off the radio, but then pressed button number 2 and put it on the classical channel, and Vivaldi was spilling from the speakers, thinking maybe that would relax her, but it didn't make any difference. I left her face and tried to think what could be making her uncomfortable. I turned the radio off again and came back to her. I bent down and undid her pigtails and ran my fingers through her soft hair. I went and got my brush. It was soft, because I hated having my hair pulled, and I brushed her hair out gently, and it fanned round her head and looked like the halo of an angel. Perhaps she wanted to be on her own for a bit. I went and stood under the scalding hot water of the shower for 20 minutes, and my skin turned pink and clean, and I came out of the bathroom. I dressed in my best pyjamas, and I lay down next to Marta. I stroked her hair, and then I tried to close her eyes again, gently, without looking at her, so that I wouldn't make her angry. She wouldn't let me close them, and I began to feel panicky. "Don't worry," I whispered. "I'm here. It's just us. We're alone. You can relax now." I thought the best thing was to just go to sleep, and I bent over to kiss her goodnight. Her mouth was slightly open, and I pressed my mouth on hers,
but her lips were stiff and her mouth didn't move. I almost screamed. "No! Stop it!" I shouted. I half crawled, half fell off the bed and scuttled backwards towards the wall where I sat, with my head banging against the base of the window. I imagined her lying there, furious with me, her eyes angry and her jaw clenched, trying to move. I stood up, moving from foot to foot, and looked at her face just for a moment. Her eyes were still open, and the expression had changed. She looked disgusted now, and her eyes seemed glazed over like the monster in a horror zombie film that Grandpa had once made me watch. Why was this happening to me? I sat, too scared to move, back against the wall, in my clothes for the second time that week, and I didn't close my eyes, not once, all night. I hadn't closed the curtains, and when the big harvest moon came up, I got on my knees and peeped over the bottom of my bed. Her face was worse than before. Her eyes seemed to be smaller and deeper in her face. She looked grey, and I reached up into the blanket and felt her foot. It was icy. I put the heating on high. Perhaps she was cold. It was autumn, and the nights were getting chilly. I paced up and down my flat, trying to think of a plan. I didn't eat, and the house was quiet. It was just her and me, and nothing else. Slowly, I began to understand that I had done a wrong thing here, and I was being punished. But I couldn't think of a way to make it better. It took a long, long time for the night to be over. The sun came up at 6:45, and I didn't feel good at all, but I knew I needed to assess the situation and stop being so upset. I pulled my chair from the desk and put it by the bed. I gently pulled her arm out from under the cover and held her hand. She was still cold. I threw a sheet over her then to make her warmer and tried to go to sleep next to her to make up for my missed night's rest. That didn't work. I could remember Grandpa telling me to take control of my life, but Marta looked so angry that I just wanted her to be gone and things to go back to normal. I wished I could take her to the fridges in the morgue or ask Pete for advice, but I couldn't, and I got more and more panicky. I hadn't eaten since before I went to work yesterday, but my appetite was gone. I felt paralyzed, and I had nowhere to look that didn't make me feel terrified. The litter tray was still outside one window and reminded me of the cat, and if I looked the other way, I could see into the bedroom with Marta on the bed, her hair peeping out from under the sheet. I got up from my computer chair, crossed the living room, curled into a ball in the bathroom, and kicked the door shut. My neighbours came back. I couldn't remember a time when they had both been out all night, but that might have been because I didn't usually notice where they were or what they were doing. This week had changed everything. At 7 o'clock, I heard Dr. Karen on the stairs. I knew the sound of her walk. She stopped outside my door. I could hear that too, but after a minute she carried on. I didn't want to see her, not at all. At 8 o'clock, I heard the door again, and the door to the downstairs flat and the outside door both shut. Now everyone was home, and I didn't know what to do. I opened the door of the bathroom and looked out. Marta was still on the bed, and the flat was very hot. I had put the heating on constant and maximum, and I hoped it had made her warmer. It took me a long time to get across the room, but I managed it, and her hand was still outside the blanket, and it looked warmer and a bit purple. I picked it up. It was warmer, but I didn't feel better. Thursday was supposed to be another work day, but now it wasn't. It would have to be a day of trying to think what to do. I didn't know where to start. I sat thinking while people came and went. Karen stopped outside my door again and said my name quietly, but I didn't say anything back. I heard banging again at 10 o'clock and wondered if it was the police. I didn't go, and I opened my door to hear, but it wasn't them. It was Marta's brother, looking for her. I almost shouted out to tell him she was in my flat. He could have taken her with him. But I was too scared. The day was long,
and I picked up the phone lots of times to call the police, then stopped. Where would they put me? I knew they wouldn't understand why I had done any of the things I had done, and I didn't want to be in prison with dirt and people all around me. I thought of getting on a train to the seaside, or onto an aeroplane, but Mother had my passport, and I couldn't just leave Marta here in my bed. I took off my jumper, and felt cross that she needed the flat this warm. I decided that I couldn't sleep in the bedroom ever again, so I put on my yellow marigold gloves that I used to clean and picked up the broom that Marta had touched the day before. I was on tiptoes again and had to have four tries, but I got the window next to the litter tray open and pushed it off into the space down the side of the house with the broom. I didn't look at it, but even then I was a little bit sick in my mouth and decided to throw the broom down too. I hoped the policeman downstairs didn't see, but I really didn't care any more. I put the cushions from the sofa in a pile and took off the covers one by one. I threw the one I had used to make Marta quiet across the room and put the others under my head, under the window, which was now closed tight, and the germs from the tray were gone so I could breathe without getting sick. I still had the same clothes on, but I didn't want to take them off with her in the flat, and it was so hot I didn't need a blanket. I closed my eyes, back against the wall, and I went to sleep. When I woke up, it was Friday. I still had no plan, but I was determined to make one. I went to the bathroom without looking at the bed at all. I had decided that I would ignore Marta and Google how to dispose of bodies. When I opened the door to come out of the bathroom, I sat straight down at the computer. It took me most of the day to do my research. None of the ways they suggested seemed as if they would work now that Marta was in my flat. I couldn't cremate her without anyone noticing, or bury her, or cut her up. If I had a bath, I could have dissolved her in acid, but I didn't have a bath, or acid, and I didn't know where to get any. I would have to leave if she couldn't. There was no other way. I could go to a hotel, a clean one. Before I left, I would go into the bedroom and check she was still there. I thought she would be, but I had remembered how often Grandpa said, "It's all in your mind, you retard. You're imagining the whole thing." Although I knew that Grandpa was just saying that to confuse me, I hoped that just this time I had imagined it, and it had been a dream. I put my hand on the bedroom door handle and turned it slowly. The bedroom was even hotter than the living room, because they had the same size radiator. But the bedroom was smaller, and the air hit me. I could almost taste it, a sweet smell which was like the rotten carrots that Mother had once left in the cupboard and forgotten about, and which had turned into liquid before Grandpa made me throw them away. I put my hand over my mouth and ran to the bathroom. I was sick, but I hadn't eaten anything, so nothing came out. I splashed some water on my face. I needed to go back in there and get clothes to take with me if I was leaving. I could shower when I arrived at the Holiday Inn I had found on the internet. I covered my mouth with my flannel and sprayed aftershave in front of me as I went in. Even though I knew the smell must mean she was in there, I looked towards her now, hands waving, standing on the balls of my feet. The bed looked different. Marta's shape looked bigger, and you could see the outline of her face through the sheet as if someone had been in there with yellowish-brown paint. It looked as if her mouth was sticking to the sheet, and the outline was darker, like lipstick, even though I had washed her. I couldn't look any more, so I took three sets of clean clothes and one pair of fresh trainers and shut the bedroom door. Then I backed away from Marta and the memory of the cat and the smell and tiptoed towards the door, trying not to make any noise. I opened it behind me, latch, then handle. I was standing on the landing, with the door finally closed behind me, when I heard footsteps coming towards me, and I screamed. Chapter 12. Karen. Everybody who is incapable of learning has taken to teaching. Oscar Wilde. Thursday morning. Back to square one. That was the depressing reality that greeted Karen as she opened her eyes. Nick was gone from the morgue and was doing his utmost not to interact with her at all now, not taking her calls or, as far as she could tell, coming out of his flat at all. She had stopped outside his door on her way to work this morning, but the flat was silent. She knew he was in there. The lights were on, and the heating was on so high you could feel it on the landing. Karen had reverted immediately to her usual pattern of overwork, now that her dream case study was no longer available at the hospital or at home, and after the general humiliation of the past week, which had culminated in both her sex life and her work life crumbling to nothing. It had been enough to make her resort to a 2 a.m. finish and a quick sleep in the on-call room at the hospital on Wednesday night. She couldn't face Nick, and she was doing her best to avoid Tam. She had only gone home to change her clothes and shower, and even then hadn't been able to avoid him, coming home as she was getting ready for another pointless day at work. He had looked like a tramp, and as he was in the same clothes he had been wearing when she had seen him on Tuesday evening, presumably he smelt like one too. She had ignored him. Well, just looked at him for a minute, which was long enough to notice that he had a huge love bite on his neck that was nothing to do with her. She had dodged a bullet there. It had taken him less than 24 hours to soothe his wounds by finding a new sexual partner. She had collated all the information she had gathered on Nick, and it amounted to a pitiful 10 pages. Even after spending the morning padding it out with observations over the last 3 years at Staverton Road, she had given up in the end. There was no way she had enough to present as a study. Karen sat down and poured herself a coffee. Could she find another job for Nick? Perhaps she could employ him herself. Her life had spun full circle in the space of a few days, from a new relationship with her neighbour which had fizzled out completely, to the screaming culmination of her life's work and a fresh start with her children, to having gone not one step further forward. She wasn't prone to feeling depressed, but she certainly felt as close to futile as she ever had. She picked up her phone. 3 missed calls from her ex-husband. Her finger hesitated over the call button, then she put the phone down. She couldn't take his sarcastic tone this morning. He had been almost pleasant the other evening when he had picked the kids up from her flat, and would no doubt have something to say about yet another relationship coming to nothing. His words rang in her ears. "No one could live with you. You're a work-obsessed, frigid bitch with no warmth or mothering instinct in your whole body." For the first time, Karen thought he might have a point. She spent the next hour googling different criteria for scientific paper submissions, and tried to find something that demanded less data. Karen knew in her heart that there was no point in submitting to a less prestigious body. Her ideas and research would be discredited before they were even published. All she really had left now was some nebulous ideas and a non-existent case study. She closed her computer and rubbed her eyes. Her phone flashed green again.
"Yes, Karen speaking."
"Karen, I'm at the kids' school. Didn't you get my message about Jamie? I asked you to come."
"I'm at work. You know, the cupboard I go to every day to earn a living while you make scones and daisy chains."
Karen almost bit her lip. It had been a long week, but it never worked to go on the attack with Charlie. He just hit back harder.
"Sorry, Charlie. Having a stressful day at the computer. What's the problem?"
"That makes a change. They've called me in to see the special educational needs person. Apparently Jamie is very withdrawn in class and not socializing. I thought that this might get you down here for a change. I know you think the rest of their education is beneath you."
The barbed remark missed its mark. Karen was still concentrating on the first part of what Charlie had said.
"There's nothing wrong with Jamie. Where are you now?"
"I'm still waiting to go in. The appointment's in 20 minutes, which you would know if you ever listened to your voice messages."
Karen grabbed her keys and was in her car within 2 minutes. She parked on the zigzag white lines outside the school and raced across the playground. She had never been inside before. Parents' evenings were Charlie's territory, and she had more than enough to do already. This was something else, though, and she was furious.
The headmaster was sitting opposite her children's father when she arrived.
"Hello, I'm Jamie's mum. What have I missed?"
She had, in fact, completely missed Jamie, sitting on his own on the chair behind his father,
hugging his knees and staring down at the floor. She had already launched into the explanation of how she knew that there was nothing wrong with her son, citing her long experience of working with children with a variety of learning difficulties, from ADHD to Asperger's and every other variety of autism. The room was quiet, and after she had finished, she realized that the headmaster hadn't spoken at all since she'd come in, and Charlie was quietly shaking his head, hand on their son's shoulder.
"Hello, Jamie. Shouldn't you be in a lesson?"
Jamie put his thumb in his mouth, didn't look at her, but hugged his knees tighter to him and clenched his fists. Something rang a bell deep in Karen's head, and she looked at her youngest with fresh eyes. She had left Charlie and the kids when Jamie was still a baby, and she had to admit their relationship was distant. She had been waiting for him to grow up a bit for them to get closer. She enjoyed the company of older children, well, teenagers, really, and had always thought that was when she would come into her own as a mother. The headmaster looked at Karen.
"Thank you very much for attending today. We are all here to offer some much-needed support to Jamie, who's finding socializing in his lessons a bit of a struggle at the moment, aren't you, Jamie? I appreciate that you feel there's not a problem. Would you say that when Jamie is with you, he is verbal and engaged? Sorry for being so direct, but you seem to have already come to a firm conclusion, and I would appreciate your input. As you know, Jamie is by any standards gifted, despite his young age. It's been noticed by the staff who run the after-school computer club, where he is streets ahead of children several years older than him. But even his skill with computers and programming doesn't compensate Jamie for the isolation and bullying he's suffering, and we all need to decide whether this is the most appropriate place for him to further his education and maximize his potential. That's why I've asked you to come in today. Happiness is everything when you're a kid, and you aren't very happy at the moment, are you, Jay?
Karen was irritated already, but the hippie-ish use of Jay and the nodding from Charlie combined to bring her to the edge of losing her temper.
I think I may have missed a few pages here. What's happened, and what are you suggesting? Gifted? If Jamie is excelling in programming, then this is the first I'm hearing about it. Do you understand that this is what I do for a living? Don't you think I would have recognized the signs if one of my children were in trouble? I spend my days dealing with exactly this type of presentation.
To her left, Charlie sighed deeply, then spoke. Karen, when I picked him up from you the other night, Sarah said he hadn't spoken all evening, and you hadn't spoken to him either. Who do you think you are, trying to tell me, or his teacher, or anyone, what he does or doesn't do in a day? Ask his sister, ask his brother, ask me. Just don't pretend you have any fucking clue. The headmaster nodded towards Jamie, who was now rocking backwards and forwards on his chair, something Karen realized she'd seen him do before. She looked at him, then put on her professional mantle.
Can I see the SEN assessment, please?
Karen's voice was different now, as she thought back over the last few times she had seen Jamie. He'd been quiet, too quiet, and she suddenly got a flash of him running behind his brother the other evening in Tam's flat. Had he been on his tiptoes, or was she just projecting her own thoughts onto him? Her heart was pounding, and she turned to Charlie.
Let me pick him up this afternoon, or take him now. I do these assessments all the time, and it would be gentler for him to have someone he knows in the room. Honestly, I know there have been huge gaps in my mothering, but this is my area, Charlie, and I really want to help.
I'm sorry, I'm sure that you're going to be a huge support for Jamie, and we would love to draw on your expertise, but for Jamie's sake, and as his headmaster, I think we need to have him independently assessed, and move towards having him statemented so that he can get the support he needs. As for not hearing about his skills with computers, we copy you in on all the children's reports every term, and you were invited to the prize-giving when Jamie received the Programming Cup and a Technology Prize. He was the only child in pre-primary ever to win either. Quite an occasion.
Karen opened her mouth to speak, then thought better of it. She looked at Charlie, who looked upset and unsure what to do next. This was her moment. She turned to Jamie.
The most important thing to remember is that you have done nothing wrong, Jamie. We are all here to help you. And luckily, Mummy helps people who feel different at her office at work every day. We will give you all the support we can and make sure you are in the right place to get the most out of your education and your life.
Karen asked for a word with the headmaster, and they went outside.
Would it be all right if I took him home with me? Just today? I noticed that he's rocking backwards and forwards in his chair, and I don't think it would help anyone if he went back to class now. Not the teacher, and certainly not Jamie. What happened to bring this to a head? Was there an incident this morning?
Yes. Jamie got very upset when one of the boys in his class started making fun of him, and his teacher found him curled up in the corner of the classroom, refusing to move, and screaming. We do have a strict attendance policy, and Jamie's not actually physically unwell, although we take pastoral care very seriously, and mental health and bullying are at the top of our agenda.
Look, far be it from me to tell you your job, but there are, what, 32 kids in Jamie's class, with one teacher and one TA?
33, last count.
And a lot of them don't have English as their first language?
No, about 50%, I'd say.
For a child with Jamie's condition, that is tantamount to chaos, and it can't be helping. I could come in and give him some one-to-one support in the classroom until you have the budget or the personnel to help him. Surely that would be good for him and for the school. I'm more than qualified for the role. Until then, can I take him home? I'll make sure he does any work you need him to complete and will be in constant touch, and I can assist with the statementing process, which is, as you'll know, a nightmare. If he needs to be at a more appropriate place of learning, I can help facilitate that with the help of colleagues. There are more ways of being too ill to be at school than just having a cough or cold, as you say.
That did it. The earnest headmaster was looking concerned, and Karen could almost hear him running through the seminars he had attended and remembering how important empathy and flexibility were. He took a breath.
You make a lot of sense. Okay, why don't you take him now, and we'll chat later once I've had a look at what sort of support we can offer, and you've had a chance to decide how you can help. The main issues are that day-to-day he has little or no contact with the other children and has difficulty expressing himself appropriately. He also becomes very distressed when his teacher tries to take away his headphones, which he likes to keep round his neck even when they're not turned on. In fact, on one occasion his teacher had to confiscate them to try and make him concentrate a little more in class. I think your husband may have told you. We were very concerned about his reaction. He became very upset, and it frightened the rest of the class.
Karen tried to remember, and did vaguely recall Charlie telling her about a bad day at school, and Jamie being in trouble. If she had realised what was going on, she would have been involved before this, but work had been taking up all her time. She felt as if she was in shock. Under her nose, one of her own children was displaying symptoms that she was trained to look for, but she had been too busy seeking them out elsewhere to notice. They walked back into the office. The headmaster was still speaking, but Karen had tuned out. She wanted to get Jamie out of the school and assess exactly what was going on. As they went in, Karen saw that Charlie had turned his chair towards Jamie and was trying to ruffle his hair and pat his shoulder, but was being physically rebuffed and making Jamie more agitated.
"Come on, mate. Cheer up."
Karen almost laughed. If you'd written a paper on how to make a stressful situation with an autistic kid worse, this would be a blueprint. Karen ignored him, surprised by her own unexpected mental use of the word autistic in relation to her youngest son.
"Jamie, we're going to go home now. You don't have to go back to class. Where's your coat?"
The little boy's face showed no reaction, but he unwound himself from the chair and walked towards the door, his eyes focused on the ground in front of him and his heels not quite touching the floor. Karen felt something close to excitement, and suddenly everything made sense. Jamie was exactly the type of child that she had been researching and trying to help for so long. How had this happened? It seemed extraordinary that, in a week which had seen so many highs and lows, Karen now had a chance to really be involved with Jamie, from diagnosis to treatment, and if all went well, she could show everyone what could be done with early intervention and the proper help. Nick seemed like a distant memory, and she bit down hard on her lip to stop herself welling up with a mixture of pride and relief.
Charlie trailed along behind Jamie and Karen as they headed towards the cloakroom. He was talking about the other two kids and pickup times, and Sarah having had a temperature the other evening. Karen knew that Jamie would need all her attention to make sure that there was as good an outcome as possible. She smiled at Charlie. She felt magnanimous in her new role, and she nodded reassuringly.
"Don't worry. It'll be fine. I know I haven't been there as much as I could have, but I'm going to make that up to you all now. I'll take Jamie now, and we can make a start on getting him back on track. I'll let you know exactly what's going on. Have you noticed anything I should be particularly aware of?"
"Just the stuff I've been telling you about for months. He doesn't talk, he won't play sport, he doesn't have any friends, he doesn't like hugs, or tickling, or even FIFA on Xbox."
Charlie's voice trailed off, and Karen ran over their conversations since the divorce. All she had been able to hear was him complaining, wanting more from her, and she hadn't heard him. She'd been stupid. If she had listened, she could have been concentrating on Jamie and his symptoms all this time.
Charlie was talking again, about Sarah and Jack and their arrangements, and dealing with Jamie as a family, and Karen talking to them later, and Jack's football camp.
It washed over her. She did understand that Charlie thought it was a good idea to get together with all three children and explain the implications of Jamie's problems and decide how they could all help. Karen knew that that would have to happen, but for now she wanted to get going and have some time alone with her son. Charlie clearly hadn't understood a thing about the challenges Jamie faced. Too much time had been lost already, and Karen wanted to kick herself for not picking up the signs. Quiet car rides after school, watching the television with his headphones on. Then, Karen had a lightbulb moment. Headphones.
"Charlie, why don't you just go home and have a rest? I honestly feel awful that this is my field and I hadn't noticed a thing. Jamie and I can catch up. I'll take him somewhere quiet. Can we just try and find out where his headphones are so that he doesn't feel uncomfortable?"
Charlie disappeared into the classroom and came back a few minutes later holding them, ruffled his son's hair again, apparently oblivious that pulling away and waving hands were signs that Jamie wanted to be left alone. Her ex-husband looked lost, and for the first time since early in their marriage seemed to be looking for guidance and reassurance from Karen.
"It's okay, Charlie. I'll be in touch later. Just get some rest."
Karen bent down and turned Jamie's chin gently towards her. She held out the headphones, and he took them and put them over his ears. Together they walked towards the reception. Karen filled out an absence note, the headmaster signed it, and they walked towards the car. Karen had strapped Jamie in and was about to drive away when she saw Charlie half loping, half jogging towards them. She was running out of patience.
"Listen, Karen, he just isn't used to being on his own with you. He's very dependent on his sister. She's the only one who can get through to him, really. We can come to yours later. Maybe get a pizza after you two have had a chat."
Karen thought for a moment. She needed more than a chat. She needed peace, and to be able to observe Jamie over a period of time, to see what he was and was not capable of. But she didn't want another argument.
"That sounds great. I'll let you know how we get on, and we'll take it from there."
Charlie looked relieved, and as Karen drove away, all she could think of was Jamie, and how finally all her theories could become something concrete. She looked across at him, lost in his own world. She wasn't going back to the house. It would be too stressful for both of them with Tam around and Nick below her. They needed somewhere peaceful and neutral, with no distractions. The travel lodge near the station. They could spend the night. Sarah and Jack would be fine with their father while she worked with their brother. Jamie wasn't fazed at all as they parked in the unfamiliar, concreted forecourt of the Urban Hotel. Karen walked round the car, undid his safety belt, and waited. Jamie slid out of the seat and walked alongside her quietly. His head moved to the rhythm of the music on his headphones, and he waited while Karen checked in and took the slim piece of plastic that passed for a key. Their room was utilitarian. A television, a bathroom, two queen-sized beds, and Jamie happily climbed up onto the farthest bed and waved his hands until Karen turned on the television. She found a cartoon channel and opened the bag of crisps she had bought from the machine in reception and handed them to Jamie. She needed some time, and she sat on the bed and took out her laptop, went to her documents, and opened up the diagnostic questions. She filled in his name and basic information, then moved from the pages relating to toddlers and onto the questions for 5-year-olds. She filled in his name, address, and details at the top, then plucked up her courage, walked over to her peaceful boy, and reached down to take off his headphones. Jamie screeched. It was as if he had only just realized that he was in a strange room alone with his mother on a school day. Karen gently steered his chin towards her again and tried to make eye contact. Whichever angle she came at him from, he avoided her gaze, and his hands were flapping frantically now. Karen pointed at the television, but Jamie wouldn't follow the pointing and lay on his front, kicking and grabbing for the headphones. Karen spent half an hour going through his responses to different questions, calming him down, showing him colours, smiling and noting down the complete lack of engagement. No eye contact, no ability to play independently, just a desire to line up the diagnostic toys neatly over and over again. She didn't react to his distress. She had done these tests many times, and knew that as soon as his comfort object was returned, he would be fine. The diagnosis was definitive. Jamie had high-functioning autism, and Karen's heart was racing. She told herself it was because she would be able to help him, but even she knew this at least was in part a lie. She walked over to him, observed the hands balled up by his sides, every muscle in his body taut, face grimacing and hands over his ears. She tapped his shoulder gently and held out his headphones. Within 5 minutes, his body relaxed, and the tightly shut eyes opened. Karen sat down to work out an exact diagnosis, and tried to suppress the feeling that somehow this was a good thing, and wondered what the protocol was on publishing papers about close family members. There was a deep sense of purpose in her now. She felt finally as if her life had a direction as she walked over to Jamie and covered him with a blanket. She lay down on the other bed and slept the sleep of the dead. When she woke up, Jamie was still fast asleep, earphones on, curled up on his side. Karen needed to see him in different environments, so she decided that today it was more important for them to be together than for Jamie to be at school. She rang in and explained that he was coming down with something, then looked at her messages. Her phone was full of texts from Sarah and Charlie, asking how Jamie was, where he was, when they were coming back. She sent a text to both of them, clearing the decks for the day ahead. Jamie fine, happy and going through everything and making lots of progress. Don't worry, we'll call as soon as we are home. I think he's coming down with a cold, so we'll let him sleep and we can all have a pizza later. Sorry I didn't call yesterday. Jamie was exhausted and my phone went flat. When Jamie finally woke up, Karen helped him get dressed and they drove together to a McDonald's drive-thru and picked up breakfast. Karen had told Charlie off about his Saturday morning ritual of fast food, but there were more important considerations at play, and once wouldn't hurt. Karen drove from there to a toy shop and picked up some turn-taking games, then back to the travelodge. By mid-morning, Jamie was asking for Sarah, and Karen couldn't get him to concentrate on anything. So they went to the park, and as soon as she knew Sarah would be at lunch, Karen called her. She was amazed how calm Jamie became as soon as he heard his sister's voice. Karen made a note of the reaction. Perhaps having one person to whom these high-functioning children were securely attached was part of the solution. Sarah wanted to come and see Jamie, but Karen needed more time and explained that it was easier to do all the tests at the same time.
"Mum, he's never been away from me for this long. Can you bring him over later?" "Of course, Sarah. I'll go back to the flat with him. It's really important that we all work together to help him, so if you can just give me a little more time, we can really get on top of things and put a plan in place to make Jamie's life as fulfilling and happy as we can."
Then Karen finally called Charlie. She needed one more day. As time had gone on, Jamie had become more and more withdrawn, until Karen had given up completely, exhausted, mentally and physically. She tried to explain the situation.
"Charlie, just calm down. Of course I can be trusted. Look, the kind of parenting you're talking about, which works so well with the other two, won't work with Jamie. I know it seems harsh, but
If you just let him stay one more night, he can come home and we can all get back to normal.
Karen, I'm not leaving him with you any longer. He isn't used to being away from us all, and it won't do him any harm to come home for supper. Just tell me where you both are. Let me speak to him.
I know what I'm doing.
Karen switched her phone off as Charlie carried on, shouting about custody and his rights.
What about Jamie's rights?
Karen wished she had never given him so much control. She should have thought ahead. What was it Charlie always said? Stop trying to fix the world and look at what's under your nose. By Friday night, she was relaxed again. The weekend stretched ahead. Charlie would calm down. He always did. Jamie was too tired to do anything else tonight, so she ordered pizza and sat next to him on the bed. She carefully cut the pizza into equal-sized pieces as Jamie watched. She offered him the box, and he took a piece. Karen took the corresponding one on the other side of the box, and they sat together, looking at the screen in front of them with no sound. Jamie pointed at the pictures of the deer in Richmond Park. At some point during the night, Karen realized she had fallen asleep next to Jamie, covered them both with a duvet, and plugged her phone in. They slept, back to back, in their own worlds.
Chapter 13 Tam. Waste no more time arguing about what a good man should be. Be one. Marcus Aurelius. Thursday morning. Banging. He could hear banging coming from somewhere, and he pulled the pillow over his head to block it out. He needed to sleep. And if someone had decided to do building work today, it would be the icing on the mouldy cake that was his life. It wasn't stopping, and through the fog of his hangover, Tam realized that it was knocking coming from the hallway. It was the front door. He hauled himself to his feet and padded barefoot across the hall, rubbing eyes that felt as though they had glass shards in them. He was not in the mood for conversation. He pulled the door open.
"Yes? What can I do for you, mate?"
Tam tried to incorporate some menace into the inquiry, or at least convey that he was keen to be left alone, until he realized that the guy in front of him, in a wife-beater vest bearing the legend Hutnik Varshava and a tattoo on his arm of a crest involving knives and wolves, was probably not someone it was wise to be snappy with, alone on a doorstep in the middle of a weekday morning. He was glaring at Tam, and his bare chest had never felt quite so inadequate or lacking in muscle tone as it did right now.
"Sorry, I was asleep. Can I help you?"
"I looking my sister. She come to this house address yesterday evening and she not come home."
"Sorry, mate. I haven't seen anyone and I don't know her. Two other people live in the house. Who was she visiting?"
"She cleans houses. She came about job."
The young man took out the folded postcard from the newsagent's window and showed it to Tam. You weren't actually supposed to remove the cards. He had paid 10 quid to have that there for a week, but it probably wasn't a good idea to point that out right now. Tam nodded and attempted a smile, which was not returned. He took the postcard back, on which the friendly Warsaw supporter had written Alexei and then his mobile number.
"Oh, yeah. She rang me last night. I was out, and we said we'd speak later. She didn't come here. I told her I was in a pub."
"Fucking slut girl. She always disappearing. She showed me card to let her leave. If she come here, you tell me. If she come for job. Better she stay in Poland. London not good place for girls."
Muttering to himself in Polish, the unwelcome visitor wandered off down the path, and Tam rubbed his head. He plinked 2 Alka-Seltzers into a glass and sat down at the computer, idly googling the attack in the park. Still no leads. He walked into the kitchen, opened the freezer and picked up the bin bag. Disappearing cleaners, dead cats, bags of clothes in the bin. He was either in denial and missed being a policeman, or he was overtired. He looked at his watch. 10 o'clock Thursday morning. The week had disappeared again. He stripped off his lounging trousers and t-shirt. It was hot in the flat, and it smelt like hell. He needed to chuck out the rubbish from the bin he'd rescued the day before.
It was all too much, and the flat was like an oven. Tam lay back down and pulled the covers over his head. Things would look clearer after a bit more sleep. When Tam woke up next, he couldn't work out if he had been asleep for another 12 hours or 12 minutes. There was a sweet smell in the air, mixing with the sweat and strawberries, and he pulled back the curtain to look outside. It was dark. He needed to pull himself together. Self-indulgence was fine, but enough was enough, and it had all stopped feeling even close to fun. He unstuck himself from the sheets and sat naked on the edge of the bed. Looking down, he tried to assess the source of a dull pain in his cock. There seemed to be a series of burns on it, but he couldn't be sure. Then he remembered the teeth. Even his ass hurt, and the pain reminded him that she had jammed some very long nails up there too. He'd been too pissed to feel much since. Sobering up was not all it was cracked up to be. He walked gingerly to the bathroom and wished he had a bath to lie in. He was getting too old for this shit. Tam sat on the loo, and peeing turned out to be an act of bravery. What didn't sting ached, and he could hear himself half panting, half yelping, as the different areas of damage were bathed in uric acid. Through the closed door, he heard two bangs at the side of the house, and then silence. He got up, went back into the bedroom, and peered out into the gloom. All he could see was a broom on its side. Probably the foxes after rubbish again. He sat on the edge of his bed and picked up his phone. It was 7 o'clock. He clicked onto his Hungry Horse app and ordered some cheap, carb-filled dinner. He scanned his phone looking for a message from Karen, a free pass out of the self-constructed quagmire he'd wandered into, but there was nothing from her. Tam thought he'd give it one more try. He walked up the stairs to the top floor and knocked. Nothing. He hadn't heard much movement in the house since he'd been back, just the door above him closing quietly when he had got rid of the Polish guy earlier. Now, silence. He leant against the landing wall for a few minutes. The landing was warm too, and the smell was worse up here. Maybe there were pigeons or squirrels in the roof. Did that smell? He thought about investigating, then decided it was probably a job for when he was feeling stronger. All he needed was to find the maggoty body of some urban creature tonight. The pizza arrived, and Tam opened the can of ginger beer that had come with it and turned on the telly. There was a game of women's football on. He watched it, numbed out, with one hand down the front of his tracksuit trousers, gently cupping his wounds. Old-fashioned comfort. The evening passed in a haze, where advert breaks allowed him to think. What was he doing with his life? Tam woke up on Friday to the same sickly sweet smell as the day before. It seemed to be all through the house, which was still as quiet as a tomb when he went out to get his post. He turned, out of habit, to the table in the hall, but it was empty, and the letters were scattered all over the mat. No one had picked up their mail for a couple of days by the look of it, so maybe he had scared Karen off permanently when he had reappeared yesterday morning. He hadn't looked great, he had to admit. Fuck her. She had messed him around from the beginning, and it was up to him what he did with his days and his nights. He tried to push down the worry that something had happened to her. He couldn't remember her ever going away before. It was time to draw a line under the whole messy relationship with Karen and move on. He stood up and headed for the shower. Tam opened the bathroom cabinet and took out a bar of Pears coal tar soap. He unwrapped it, and the smell of school nights and his father and cold winter mornings hit him. He'd used it all the way through police academy, and this morning it felt more appropriate than shower gel. He stood under the jets of the shower and lathered his body from top to bottom. It stung the wounds from his encounter with Molly on Wednesday night, but he enjoyed the penance. He even washed his face and hair with it, and it drove the strange odour of the flat from his nostrils. 2 bowls of cornflakes later, Tam was feeling good. It was early afternoon. Fresh air was needed, and a fresh start. He tidied the bed and gave the bathroom a once-over. The news featured another appeal by the parents of the poor guy killed in the park, and Tam instinctively picked up his phone to see if Danny had any news. There were 3 emails to his new personal non-work account. Tam had only set it up a couple of days ago and had given that email address to Danny. He felt excited for the first time since he had parted from the commissioner the week before. Danny had never been one to waste words, and the first one just said, Tam, call me, it's urgent, Danny. Then, Tam, I am not taking the fall for this, we need to talk. And finally, the DNA has come back as a match, and I am not going to be responsible.